Good evening. Good evening, everybody. If I could... oh, what a good group. You guys are very, very attentive tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you all. We are about to start here at the historic Mark Hopkins Hotel at altitude in San Francisco. My name is Doug McConnell, and it is my pleasure...
Wow.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. I don't normally get that, especially at home, so it's nice to hear it. We are now going to begin a wonderful evening of stories, of inspiration from some extraordinary people, meet some extraordinary people in our annual Galen and Barbara Rao Memorial Lecture presented by this great team, the Commonwealth Club of California, great organization, our partner for a long, long time. And my pal, the extraordinary George Dobbins, is back there somewhere making this all work. Thank you, George, very much. the Rao Legacy Committee, the countless hours, the volunteer work of the Rao Legacy Committee for such a long time. Would the Rao Legacy Committee please stand for one second? I want to get a round of applause here. Oh, what a good feeling here tonight. And our parent organization, we started there, we went away, and we've come back. As Karen Collins said recently, it is true, you can come back home. And I want to thank and acknowledge and cheer on Nature Bridge, formerly Yosemite National Institutes. Thank you so much. We are so fortunate to be part of Nature Bridge, and this will be a relationship that will last now for a very, very long time. I also want to thank our generous sponsors, and first I want to mention an organization that was called until last week Yosemite Fund, now Yosemite Conservancy. Yosemite Conservancy, great organization. And I want to thank Yosemite Fund, Yosemite Conservancy, for taking us on also for a couple of critical years and shepherding the Rao Award through some really important times. So it's wonderful to have the Conservancy with us here tonight and in the years ahead. I want to thank the Miller Law Group, another one of our generous sponsors. New Resource Bank, a great bank supporting environmental efforts and undertakings. And, of course, Galen and Barbara's Mountain Light Gallery in Bishop, Mountain Light Gallery. And to that end, I want to especially acknowledge tonight Galen's daughter, Nicole, is here, and Tony Ryan is here. Tony, where are you? Tony Rao, and Nicole Rao Ryan. Tony and Nicole, thank you very much. Okay, now I'm on my big job, the Commonwealth Club, and I want to ask you to please turn off all cell phones, pagers, satellite phones, GPS enabled devices. All the high tech now needs to go away and be turned off, except for some extraordinary images we're going to see in just a little bit. And we're going to now go to very low tech. Between now and 9 o'clock, you'll notice that there were some question cards placed on your seats. So if you would, begin now, and while he's talking, write down some questions for David Brashears. And after David's talk, we'll have a little bit of time, 10 or 15 minutes, to try to go through a few of those questions. So you can please do that in the lowest tech possible way. We are really delighted to have to be here tonight to move forward with our Rao Award and our Rao Lecture. I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. Obviously, there's a whole lot of reasons for that, but it's great to see this room so filled. How many of you have been to a Rao Lecture before? Terrific. And how many of you, is this the first time? So about half and half. Well, thank you to those who are returning. Thank you to those who are coming. Let me just take a few minutes and talk a little bit about Galen and Barbara. And they are there with us. They would thoroughly enjoy this evening. This would be an evening that they would love, with people that they admire and respect about topics that they cared about, you know, very, very deeply. Simply put, from my point of view, and I think for many of us, Galen and Barbara were two of the most extraordinary people I have ever met and had the privilege to know. Renaissance people, creative, brilliant, curious, empathetic, very, very, very disciplined, and they loved life, and they lived it very, very large. They were many, many things, of course, but they were three things in particular as appropriate for tonight. They were artists, certainly extraordinary photographers, Barbara as well as Galen, but of course Galen was one of the premier nature, wildlife, adventure photographers in the world, taking us with him on his great adventures with extraordinary images. Barbara, a great creative person, great visual instincts herself, of course, and was learning video towards the end, and I'm sure had a little more time gone on, she would have put many of us who do video for a livelihood to shame. So they were artists. They were adventurers, obviously. Traveled to the ends of the earth, far, wide, and near, close here to home. Barbara was a pilot, of course. Galen, a world-class climber, a world-class athlete. And they were also activists. Very importantly, they were activists. They didn't just take photographs and write their extraordinary books and come back and then move on to the next thing. They gave back to the places that they traveled, the people that they got to know, to make a difference. Of course, locally, even here as well, they were great supporters of the Yosemite Conservancy, and for about a quarter of a century, Galen was on the board of what is now NatureBridge, formerly Yosemite National Institute. They both, of course, passed away, died in 2002, and the plane that they were being flown in crashed on a dark night going into Bishop, back to their home. So friends and family rallied, so many friends and family rallied to try to figure out how we were going to honor their legacy and create some kind of a living legacy that would, in a sense, carry on the mission that so empowered their lives, to encourage and to inspire and to financially support the next generation of artists, activists, and adventurers, to create a legacy that would continue for many, many years to come. And so we created the Raoul Award for the Art of Adventure, and here we are tonight. The Raoul Award, I'm just going to read the words that we wrote about the Raoul Award because we worked hard to try to find what we really meant by this. And the Raoul Award honors that adventurer whose artistic passion illuminates the wild places of the world and whose accomplishments significantly benefit the environment and the people who inhabit these lands and regions. And so over the course of the last couple of years, we've had our Raoul lecture that we are about to have. We'll get to hear from David Brashears. We have given our Raoul Award for the Art of Adventure. This will be our fourth one tonight to Craig Childs, and we'll get to hear from Craig as well. And I want to thank again all of you for coming because the event raises much of the money we need to have to be able to give to Craig and the Raoul Award winners a check for $15,000 to not only encourage them and to honor them, but to financially provide some support. So thank you again for participating in all of that. So this will be our fourth award, and we're going to hear from Craig in just a second. But first, we wanted to take just a minute and find out what's been going on with the three people who have received the award before, Jimmy Chin, Beth Wald, and James Balog. And so we're going to show some videos, starting with some wonderful pictures, great photographs from Jimmy Chin, and this will show you where Jimmy has been the last little bit of time. Thank you. Oh, Jimmy's been on the road. Amazing photographer, an amazing guy, with Galen on Galen's last great adventure in Tibet in 2002. Well, Beth Wald was our second winner, extraordinary woman, a photographer, and a someone who met every single criteria we had for our RAL Award winner. And Beth has been spending quite a bit of time in Afghanistan. Beth Wald.
After receiving the 2006 Rawal Award, I returned to Afghanistan several times, where I continued to photograph the last remaining wild places of that war-torn country, as well as the unique tribes that inhabit these remote regions. In the spring of 2007, I made my third trip with conservation biologist George Schaller, this time to explore the state of the environment in the northwest corner of Afghanistan. We were looking for leopard, cheetah, gazelle, and wild ass. We found that most of the wildlife had been shot out and that the grasslands and forests were being overgrazed and plowed up for farms. Efforts, however, are now underway to conserve the last of these important habitats. That same season, I traveled to and photographed the beautiful Ajar Valley in the central Hindu Kush Mountains in Bamiyan Province. There, biologists from the Wildlife Conservation Society are working with local communities to create a wildlife preserve and national park. In January of 2008, I returned to the Wakhan Corridor in Afghanistan in the northeast and traveled back into the Pamirs to visit Wakhi and Kyrgyz families that I had met in 2004 and to photograph their lives in the brutal winter season. It was a very difficult journey. My Wakhi guide, Malang, and I walked for days through howling wind, snowstorms, and bitter cold to reach the first Kyrgyz nomad camps in the Little Pamir. There we were received with kindness and warm hospitality, and the families opened their lives to me and to my camera, which was an inspiration and a huge responsibility. I only hope that my photographs capture a little of the struggles, dignity, and pride of the Kyrgyz and the Wakhi people, and the harsh beauty of their home on the roof of the world. I will be returning to Afghanistan and the Pamirs in August of this year to continue this work.
It was wonderful when he gave Beth the award. She came directly from Afghanistan here just to receive the award that night and jumped on a plane virtually the next day and went back. Amazing woman. And finally, our third RAL Award winner was Jim Balog. And many of you know Jim Balog for many different activities and his marvelous photography work over the years. But in particular, we honored him for his work to measure the rapid disappearance of glaciers and ice caps on this planet as global warming grabs the biosphere and won't let us go. So Jim Balog and his amazing work with the Extreme Ice Survey, and this is what Jim has been up to.
Most of the time, art and science stare at each other across a gulf of mutual incomprehension. In the Extreme Ice Survey, we're dedicated to bringing those two parts of human understanding together, to merging the art and science to the end of helping us understand nature and humanity's relationship with nature better. As a person who's been a professional nature photographer my whole adult life, and firmly of the belief that photography, video, film have tremendous powers for helping us understand and shape the way we think about nature and about ourselves in relationship to nature. Per million beyond what nature has naturally done in the past million years. That's a big, big
thing. And you know what?
Because you can't change the physical chemistry of the atmosphere. I've been looking forward to this Copenhagen meeting for so long, and I've so wanted to have the story of these glaciers presented in this setting. So I'm thrilled to be here and have yet another chance to throw these images out on the waves and spread them around the world.
And again, to find out more about what Jim is up to, James Balog, go to extremeicesurvey.org. You'll see images that are just absolutely riveting, compelling, and pretty darn scary. And again, if you want to know more about the Rowell Award in the future, go to rowellaward.com and read more about our winners and hopefully stay involved. We'll talk about that at the very end of the evening tonight. It's very, very, very hard to choose these winners because we have nominations that come to us. Those of you who are here tonight can nominate. Nominations come from all sorts of places. And then finally, after a selection process and a judging panel gets together, very, very difficult choices have to be made around some extraordinary people doing extraordinary work. But clearly we've had three marvelous Rowell Award winners, and now we have a fourth. And it is my great pleasure to introduce our fourth Rowell Award winner, Craig Giles. And let me just read a little bit about Craig. An accomplished writer, Craig Giles has published more than a dozen critically acclaimed books on nature, science, and adventure. Among his recent titles, The Animal Dialogues, Uncommon Encounters in the Wild, The House of Rain, Tracking a Vanished Civilization Across the American Southwest, and The Desert Cries, A Season of Flash Floods in a Dry Land. Craig is informed by lengthy wilderness expeditions that span several weeks or months. His writing conveys a hard-earned sense of landscape and culture. The New York Times says Craig's feats of asceticism are nothing if not awe-inspiring. He's a modern-day desert father. He's been called a born storyteller by many people. And the Los Angeles Times says his writing is like pure oxygen and stings like a slap in the face. He won several significant awards, including the Sigurd Nelson Nature Writing Award and the Spirit of the West Award for his body of work, an honor that he shares with a couple of other fledgling writers, including Wallace Stegner, Terry Tempest Williams, and N. Scott Momaday, in very, very good company. Craig Giles is an Arizona native and grew up spending time both in his home state and in Colorado. In his teens, Craig began working as a river guide, and since then he has held numerous jobs to support his field time, from gas station attendant to journalist to beer bottler. Now making a living as a writer, Craig lives off the grid with his wife and his two young sons at the foot of the West Elk Mountains in Colorado. Extraordinary guy, great legacy, great stories. In the past, we've had photographers as our Rowell Award winners. Now we have this wonderful writer. It is my great privilege to introduce Craig Giles, our Rowell Award winner for this year.
That's good. That's really good.
And the applause should keep going for a long time. We are going to do two things with Craig. First, I'm going to give him a check because we do award our REL winners $15,000. I took out five, though, if that's okay. Just, you know, I had some needs. Okay. But the second thing we're going to do, and this is the first time we have had a chance to do this, we now have, and, you know, Jimmy and Beth and, you know, Jim will get one of these, too. We now have an actual plaque that we have made that is on granite that, of course, Galen would love an awful lot. And this is our RAL Award for the Art of Adventure, Craig Childs, our 2009 recipient. Thank you very much, Craig. You're terrific.
Appreciate that.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for moving the passion and experience of Galen Rowell forward, and also for helping me to move my own passion and my experience forward. I believe in landscapes and experiencing them inside and out, experiencing them in as sharp a detail as possible, which is, I think, what my life is about, is moving into these places, wherever they are on the planet, and understanding them, tasting them, drinking them. I drink the water wherever I go, no matter what it is. I've had so much flood water, flash flood water, that I just, in the desert, haven't been able to help myself but just scoop it up in my hands and drink it and taste what that landscape is about. That's what I do. I move out there. I travel hard in the land. And I do travel around the world, but at the same time, I believe in understanding places. I believe understanding them to the hilt, which means living in them, experiencing the same canyon over and over again, experiencing a sunrise in January and then a sunrise in December and a sunrise in August, and really feeling these places. And so it's taken me a while to start writing about places outside of the Southwest. I came back from a first descent down a river in Tibet 2 years ago, and you know, we had, a wild, hairy time on a crazy river in the middle of nowhere. And when I got back, people were saying, well, when's the book on Tibet coming out? And I kept saying, I don't know anything about Tibet. I only ran a river there. I barely got to see the place. I only spent a month there. I would need years and years. And so that's why primarily I've written about the Southwest, because that is the place that I have just sunk my teeth into, the place that I belong to. And the story that I'm trying to tell is a story of what it's still like to be a tactile human being on the landscape, because often I feel like we're forgetting that. We're forgetting how to taste and touch the world. And I'm telling this story saying we're still human beings, we're still animals, we still have skin and flesh, and we can move across this landscape. I brought some images tonight, which are a cross-section of my life, basically taken out of the last month. So this is May. Was that the last month? In slot canyons in Utah, which you move through these places and you can run your hands along the walls and you can feel the last flash flood that came through there. You can feel the storm systems that drove floods down into these canyons. And when you spend time in these places, you spend years and years walking through these canyons, you get to know all the tributaries and you pick up stones and you can tell where they came from. You follow drainages down to their sources. You keep moving through this landscape until you understand it at a cellular level. You go into these dark places, these canyons that go black down at the bottom, and you know them inside and out. They don't have names. They're just places out there. I left from those canyons and headed straight to the Atacama Desert in northern Chile and spent a few weeks walking down there across a different landscape You know, the desert is my primary place. It's where I feel most comfortable, where I feel exposed. Let me read from my journal. From this is the Salar de Atacama. We hit level ground in the sunrise, back to walking on pastries of salt, boots crunching through caked surfaces, mirages pool ahead of us, mountains reflected in silver lakes that grow and twist as we watch. They look so real and clear you couldn't doubt them. Water is liquid light. We pause atop a hill of salt crystals and look across the mirage as it grows into a sea. Around us, sheaves of crystals glitter and shine in the early sun. The sea migrates around us, filling space after space. As I move out there, I write. I do take some photographs, but primarily I'm writing down what I see, which I have to have a journal nearby. I have to be wearing cargo pants because I got to pull this thing out of my pocket every 2 minutes and write down the details of what it's like. When you're walking out there on the Salar, you're surrounded by these mountain ranges made of salt, and you climb up into these ranges, and wormholes of salt are open, these sinkholes underneath you. You get to their edges, and you look down into them, and eventually you see what's down there. And these holes are dropping beneath you. And the shapes are so specific. You got to touch them. You've got to taste them. I spent so much time walking through this desert, dropping down on my hands and knees and nibbling at the ground just for the taste of the salt. Because you have to get up close to your landscape and feel it. You have to feel everything about it. You need to hear the sound of it. The stories that I'm trying to tell are this: small, delicate, what salt sounds like in the bottom of a hole. You go into these places and you try to touch them with all of your body. I remember coming off of a trip once and looking down at my fingers and realizing my fingerprints were gone. I've been touching so much rock for I think about a month of travel that my fingertips were just these glassy pads. And I was so happy to have myself replaced by the landscape that I felt like my name was finally taken away and I was part of this place. And then my fingerprints grew back and I got my name back. But I keep going out there. I keep going out and erasing myself in this place, finding places where salt is just raised up out of the ground and you put your ear against it and the salt is crackling in the heat, in the sun. And you listen to the landscape. There are so many different ways of coming to these places. You come to them as a human being, as somebody made of skin and bones, where the rivers of your senses are constantly taking in what's around you. After I got back from the Atacama, I went straight to the San Juan River in around the Four Corners area. I was putting in at Clay Hills in Utah. And it's a river that I'm very familiar with, but there's one stretch of it that nobody ever runs that goes down to Lake Powell because it's an unwanted piece of river, but it's still a question. You know, what's that little segment on the landscape that I've never seen? What's that piece of river that nobody's ever gone down? And nobody goes down because Lake Powell is backed up into it and backs sediment up into it. So it's off the map. So I went down to see what this waterfall was about because a fresh new waterfall was formed. If the computer will you hit the forward button for me? Thanks. This waterfall is fairly new. The reservoir backed sediment up. The river jumped out of its channel and started flowing across the open desert. And now it's just flowing across bedrock as a result of Lake Powell. And I'm down there writing about sedimentation and writing about a piece of river that people don't know about, even though it's right in our landscape. And I want to tell this story. I want to come out and say, there is a place out there where the river's behaving differently, where things are changing. There's a dynamic out there. The natural world is active, and we're part of it, and we're moving things along. And I was taking a ducky down for a few days, just paddling down into the lake to get a sense of what it's like to watch a river actually drown. What is it like to paddle down and feel the water slow down, feel the current disappear when you're going down into the deliverance part of the San Juan River, where just the bare bones are sticking out. Is that river still alive down there? And I found that it is. Even where the lake backs up, I'd be searching for a current, going from side to side along the spreading lake, and I'd find, 4 miles after the last current left, there'd be a new current that would rise up, that there's a ghost river flowing down there. And I was following this ghost of the San Juan downstream. I want to know what places are like. I want to know what they're like from foot to foot, mile to mile. I want to get inside of landscapes and understand them, feel them, tell people the story of what it's like to be out there. I don't care where it is, because this whole planet is full of these places. You know them. You've been there. You've traveled in them. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You have made a connection with a place. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to come out and tell the story about a place and say, don't forget. Don't forget where you're from. Don't forget what it's like to be out there, to feel this landscape, to reach into the water and pull out just a stick and go, Juniper, I know where you came from. I know how far you flowed. The little black bombs of pinion pine cones that come down into Lake Powell. You know the story of those pine cones. Even the trash and junk down there, I would track it back. I would look to see, where is this from? Who dropped this? What are the stories here? Everything is part of the story. Humans are not removed from this story. We are here. We are part of this. We make lakes. We make dams. And I'm trying to understand our relationship. And I go up into the springs. I have journals filled with observations from these springs where I'm recording, what plants are growing there, how fast is it flowing at different times of the year. This is where coming to a place over and over again really helps. So you know that this spring tastes salty at a certain time of year, and then another time of year it's clear and clean. You start to understand a landscape in that way. Intimacy, familiarity. We need to be remembering this, remembering how to go out there and see all the fine details. At that spring, there were all these columbine flowers growing, which usually associate with montane regions, Colorado. And to find these alcove columbines growing in this one little spot is just magical, especially when you know all the springs around there, when you know the whole landscape. And then you go out and you paddle and you understand the wind. And you feel it coming against you. You're pushing against this lake where there's no more current, where the river has been drowned, but you can feel the wind, and you're pushing into it. That's what it's about. It's about being stripped down, feeling it, pushing through it, understanding. That's why I write. When I got off the San Juan, I headed into Page, and I went out behind Walmart to the end of the road and then to the arroyo on the other side, looking at it, seeing how fast it's eroding, following it back and going, okay, how long is it going to take before this takes out Walmart? Understanding a landscape to that point where I can look at Walmart and go, you guys don't have a chance here. In fact, the entire town of Page is on its way out. This whole place is made of sand. In fact, Glen Canyon Dam, I understand the dynamics here. I understand how long this place is going to last. Even these little details, the trash we leave behind, the pieces of metal, I see the process that they're going through. Down there in this drainage behind Walmart, back in the 40s and 50s, they took cars and used them as riprap to keep the drainages from reaching up too far toward Page. But you go in there and you can see the cars are being digested by the canyon. They're being carried downstream. And this is in some place that nobody walks. This is just It's everywhere. All you have to do is go out there and find it, and you can see what's happening. You can see how nature is treating us. You can see our future. And to me, that future is beautiful because it is starting to melt back into the landscape where pieces of metal are jammed into the canyon and being carried downstream by flash floods. That's what I'm looking for. That's the kind of story I'm getting at. Even when I walked out of that canyon and saw these transmission lines that are coming off of Lake Powell and Glen Canyon Dam, you know, thank God for them. That's where we get our electricity. But how long is that going to last? You look at this landscape and you know how long that's going to last. This landscape is going. It's eroding. It's out the door. And eventually I came to the edge of that canyon and looked down into the Colorado River, the last remnant of the Colorado River flowing through Glen Canyon, the last piece of Glen Canyon downstream of the dam, a place that I have known for my entire life, a place that I finally feel like I can write about because I've seen it for 43 years. That's how I approach this landscape. And I do deeply appreciate you recognizing that and helping me to keep it going. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Craig, thank you very, very much. Boy, it's hard to follow that. It's hard to follow that, so I won't try. Boy, to be able to come and to meet you after all these months and to hear you is just an affirmation of all the time, the energy that so many of us have worked on this for so long. And in Galen and Barbara's honor, they would have loved this. And thank you so much. Keep it up. Well, the other piece of the evening that we've always done is to meet our RAL Award winner, and you're here with your wife, and your kids are upstairs at the top of the mark having a drink. I was giving him some tips on, you know, the Shirley Temples are great up there, by the way. they're getting a great experience in life. Now I get to introduce David Brashears, but before I do that, we've always had a wonderful speaker come, and Galen and Barbara love that. They love to have salons and have people that they knew and admired and respected come and tell tales and show great visuals, and we're going to get to do that. But before I introduce David, he has come with some other amazing people who have been with him in high places on the roof of the world, and they are here with us tonight again at the roof of San Francisco at Nob Hill. I want to read a little bit about each of them because I think it's very interesting, and we're just honored and thrilled to have you with us tonight. So first, Jangbu Sherpa, would you stand up? And stay there. This is somebody that I have admired from a distance for a very long time, and to get to meet him is thrilling. Jangbu summited Everest 5 times, including 2 times with David. He carried the camera, the lenses, about 50 pounds worth of stuff to the summit of Everest for the IMAX film that David made and was on the mountain, of course, helping to coordinate the rescue during the worst climbing disaster ever experienced in 1996, and that John Krakauer chronicled in Into Thin Air. But Jangbu, it's wonderful to have you with us, and I want to hear how you carried that stuff up at some future point. Amazing job. I've lugged really heavy gear all over the world myself, but, far removed from that feat. Kami Sherpa is here as well. Kami, stay standing if you would for a minute. He summited Everest 6 times, including once with David. We good? You coming around? Oh, you're getting your microphone. Okay. Summited Everest 6 times, including once with David. He's also the first high-altitude media reporter for Nepal Television. Great to have you with us. Wow. stories within stories, competence within competence. It's just wonderful to meet you. Nawang Sherpa. Nawang Sherpa. He summited Everest one time, but he did it with an artificial leg. Wow. And Nima Sherpa. A veteran of five Everest climbs, serving in lots of capacities, and for several renowned climbers such as Brent Bishop and Ed Vesteers. In 1996, he was the expedition sirdar for Mountain Madness, Scott Fisher's company, helping to coordinate the rescue during, again, Everest's worst climbing disaster. And wonderful to have you. Thank you so much. And now, I have a 20-minute introduction of David Brashears, but as David so nicely pointed out, let's get to the main story and tonight and celebrate Barbara and Galen and hear from David. But I have to say quickly, for those of you who, and I'm sure very few of you, if any, don't know about David Brashears, I'm going to read a quick thing, David, so bear with me. An accomplished filmmaker, adventurer, author, mountaineer, a man, again, of many parts, and a professional speaker, so you will enjoy that. Since 1978, he has combined his skills in climbing and filmmaking and artistry to complete more than 40 film projects. In 1983, he transmitted the very first live television pictures from the summit of Everest, and in 85 became the first American to reach the summit of Mount Everest twice. Probably what we know, most of us know David best for is the extraordinary IMAX film that we talked about just a minute ago in 1996, when they were summiting Everest to do the IMAX movie that then many of us saw a year or so later, when this incredible disaster on the mountain happened and 8 people died. David and his team shut down their operations. They coordinated the rescue efforts and then went on finally at the end of May of that year to summit the mountain and to finish the IMAX film, bringing everybody and their whole team home safely. So, David, again, I have everything here, including the Nobel Peace Prize, but I won't mention it all. It is my privilege and honor to bring up to the platform here for our Rao Lecture, David Brashears. David?
Lost the light on the podium. Can you see me better here? All right. I'm fine over here. It's great to be here. And to you, Craig, I've climbed a lot of mountains, and I shouldn't be out of breath, but I'm just awestruck and still trying to catch my breath. That's just so impressive, what you've done and how passionate you are. And it's wonderful to be the speaker to follow you here. Tonight, and you're in good company, by the way. I know Jimmy well. I've known Beth for 28 years and James Balog for 26 years, and now they're in good company that you're the fourth Rao Award winner. So, again, well done, man. I want to talk about Galen just for a minute, but I'll wait to do that. He's a very important figure in my life, as was Barbara. I just wanted to thank Doug and everyone for having me here. It's so extraordinary to be in this the company of all this talent and all of you committed individuals. And you keep thanking me for coming here and being a part of it. And I'm the one thanking you to be able to stand up here and talk about Galen and listen to Craig. And so really, thanks to all of you for bringing me out here for this. I just have to say one more thing before I start. In my life, those are big people in my life right there. And you'll see some of them, they're brothers from the village of Chongba and Top Ding in Solo Khumbu, which is below the upper Khumbu near the base of Everest, which, by the way, the Solo Khumbu produces all the strongest and smartest and handsomest Sherpas. In the Khumbu region. I don't get to see them often. Zhang Bu came to the United States and they all four live up in Sonoma. and work there. And I haven't seen him on the mountain for 10 years. So hi, guys. How are you? But just if you have that program, on that big day after eight people had died on Everest and we were a pretty tired team and we went back up the mountain and we needed that camera to finish our film. And the camera weighed 42 pounds. And that guy right there carried it to the top. The other fellow next to him, Kami, he's climbed Kilimanjaro three times with me for the IMAX Kilimanjaro film. And the other two are great friends. The best thing you'll ever see is Sherpas who don't grow up going to a lot of zoos is the first time you come around a corner in Arusha National Park and Kami sees six giraffes and tried to crawl out of the Land Rover and run the other way. He wasn't sure what they were. They were not anything he had ever seen. So about Galen, Galen's with us all here tonight, and he's really here with me and seeing part of his legacy, which is Jimmy Chin, who was on a big trip to Tibet, the last trip Galen was on. And to just feel his voice here and his presence in all of you. And when I was a young rock climber and I had no idea I would ever pick up a camera, we all were just stood in awe of Galen and his climbing and his adventuring and his just talent. And later we also saw in that great team, the next team member was Barbara Cushman Rao. And let me tell you, Galen was very talented and very driven and had tremendous focus and conviction and a sense of purpose. But that woman right there, Barbara, really was, they were 50-50 in that, and I hope we all remember her as well when we talk about this award. They were truly a dedicated and loving team. So, I mean, when I was around Barbara, it was all of us guys, actually. I probably Galen knew it. We all had a crush on her. She reminded me of the cool chick who would have been the high school prom queen, but would have snuck out around the back door to drink a beer with you afterwards. She was mischievous and fun. So I just wanted you to all know that because my talk here tonight is not necessarily particularly uplifting. It's about water. It's about how we, in a way, affect our planet. It's about the melt rate of the Himalayan glaciers, and that's what I've been doing for 3 years. It's all I've been doing for 3 years. It's a very simple project. I've been going to those mountains since 1979 making films. I know where the photographs are, the earliest photographs taken of certain glaciers. I go to the archives. I find the best of those photographs, which sometimes date back to 1899, 1910, and I find that same place, either near K2 or Everest or Choyo-U, and take a photograph so that we have a way of showing the world, conveying a message and getting some resonance or emotion with people that that what we're trying to tell the world about climate change and global warming, it's not a myth. It's real. It will impact our lives. And I do that with like Galen did with images. He writes a lot more than I do, but we both understood the power of images to get people's attention and at least start a dialogue. So that's what I have been up to. And now we are going to bring down the lights, and I'll get my clicker. And I'm going to go through this fairly quickly because it's normally a longer presentation, And so I'm going to give you a few clues how to make it go easier in a minute. What we're talking about here is this great big arc of the greater Himalayan range from really Namcha Barwa or Kanchenjunga in the far east here. Of course, there's Nepal, there's Bhutan, there's the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, the Tibetan Plateau, Xinjiang, and China. But this great arc goes all the way up here to K2, the northernmost 8,000-meter peak in the world. And from this range, in this range, is the largest reserves of water frozen in the form of glaciers in the subpolar regions. And what we really, why do we care about that water? Well, we're not worried about this water because of any kind of rise in sea level. There's not enough ice here to worry about. We're worried about this water because it provides, we're worried about the ice here because it provides the headwaters, water for the headwaters of five or six of the major river systems in the world, and these river systems flow into the villages and wells and farms of hundreds of millions of people. And that would be the Indus here, the Sutlej, down here the Ganga, through here the Tsongpo, which becomes the Brahmaputra here as it turns through the great bend at Namcha Barwa. Then there would be the Yangtze flowing north through China, the Yellow River, the Yangtze, the Mekong, the Salween, and the Irrawaddy. So this water is important, and it's disappearing at an alarming rate. It's important because it provides a seasonal water flow. It doesn't. There's not a lot of rain or snow in most of the Himalayan region in the winter months. It's quite dry there. So what the rivers count on and the people count on are for these glaciers to slowly melt in the winter and release their water in a steady, reliable manner. Here's where the project started for me in October of 2007 on the north face of Everest in Tibet, an area I know very well. Frontline, that great PBS documentary series that I've worked for over the years, wanted a picture of a melting glacier in the Himalayas for their program. And I chose the main Rongbuk Glacier here because I'd been here many times, and I knew Mallory, George Mallory, who died here in 1924, had taken a picture of this glacier. So I got that photo out of the archive of the Royal Geographical Society and went to Rongbuk Monastery, underfinanced, without the normally dedicated and strong Sherpa team, and hired two monks from the monastery at 16,200 feet. I wasn't worried about their capacity to do what we were about to do. They're strong and fit and born and raised at 16,000 feet. So this was the first Glacier Works GRIP, Glacier Research Imaging Team, and off we went up to find this photo point of Mallory's where he had stood in 1921 when the British were trying to map Everest and find a way up it. It was a reconnaissance expedition. At first, I was quite excited within a few hours to find we were on the trail of a wolf pack of six wolves, and then an hour later to find out we were following the fresh, wet mud tracks of a snow leopard. So although it looks stark and desolate up there, as I was soon to see here, there is wildlife here, and somehow it manages to survive against every attempt of mankind to exterminate those species. Here's when we first started to know something was really wrong. When you see large standing bodies of water like this on a glacier, it's basically the beginning of the end. The devastation lower down on the main Rongbuk Glacier was quite dramatic, and it's And as we climbed higher, I wasn't sure if we would get a result. And to think of back of it, I actually thought, well, this would be a terrible long journey to Tibet for a single photograph if we don't get a result. And I found myself feeling quite guilty for wanting a result. But I finally scrambled up to around 19,000 feet, holding Mallory's 1921 photograph in my hand. And there I put the two photos side by side, and that's Everest in 1921, and this is Everest in 2007. Now, it doesn't look very dramatic when they're just sitting side by side like that. And here's where we're going to pick up the pace, and what I need all of you viewers to do is not look at the mountain. The mountain is irrelevant, and to look at the glacier, and to remember that many of these glaciers are debris-covered glaciers, type D glaciers. They have 6 or 7 inches of pebbles and small rocks on the surface. So this is a glacier here. But in the span of 80-something years, just pick a spot and focus on it, and this is what you see had happened. The glacier had melted vertically over 350 feet. And there's so then we go in tighter and we take another picture. And then we overlay those two pictures. And again, pick a spot here and look at this massive sea of ice. I was so shocked because really this is the Himalayas. These are the highest glaciers in the world. Somehow I thought they would never melt. And to see what's happened in just 80 years was very surprising. In fact, we'll show you the scale when you look at this ice pinnacle here. And remember, the glacier was up here. Well, really, how far is that? Well, we can see a picture of Jimmy Chin's that we saw in his little presentation. And so that's how big it is. Those ice pinnacles are massive. And so that was about 350 to 450 feet of glacier loss there. This is a big panorama of the West Rongbuk Glacier. I was standing here a few months ago. Now I've come back on another trip. There's Everest, there's Pumori, there's Lhotse, there's Nupsi. This is the frontier between Tibet and Nepal. And look at the difference here. And what's the problem here is that as the accumulation zone keeps moving up the glacier, as the temperature increases, the snow line rises, suddenly there's no accumulation zone, there's no glacier. It just dies. This is glaciers, contrary to a lot of popular belief, don't gain most of their mass from snowfall down in areas like this. They gain their mass from heavy snows in accumulation zones that just through their sheer weight press on the ice and force it down. And that's why you see these long, essentially conveyor belts, slow motion conveyor belts hauling debris down the mountain. And so we'll just go through a few of these very quickly. This is 1921 by the British. There's 2008. There it is showing you. There's tremendous accuracy associated with these pictures. When you watch this next dissolve, you will see that point and that point do not move. The glacier lost about 350 vertical feet here. We know because we walk out here with laser rangefinders and measure the vertical loss of ice. So I'll stand here and measure, shoot the laser here, and shoot it here all up and down this glacier so that we have accurate data to support this. This is the East Rongbuk Glacier, the route first taken by the British in 1921. In the reconnaissance, they found this way to the summit. They made attempts here in 22 and 24 before Mallory perished up here with George Mallory, with Irvin, June 8th, 1924. And just look at the condition of this glacier. These are small feeder glaciers. These are the veins and the arteries that keep this glacier alive. They no longer exist in that picture. And by the way, did anyone invite Rush Limbaugh to the conference? These pictures are doctored. They're not real. Anyway, watch this. It's just really shocking when you... And here's, again, this glacier was quite full in through here. I just mark things mentally. I call that the eye, and then I watch that, and then I look at this next picture, and then you see that there were 600 feet of glacier, and that's only in 80-something years. This really, really surprised me. I wasn't ready for this. We moved over to Choyoyu, the world's sixth highest mountain, 26,900 feet. By the way, a lot of people here in this room know a lot about Tibet. Galen and Barbara absolutely love to travel in Tibet, and Galen did some of his best work there, and I've always been very fond of his book that he did with His Holiness called My Tibet. But this was the route for many years that Tibetan traders used to get over into the Khumbu. This is where the past Tibetans crossed 700 years ago and founded settlements in the Khumbu region. Sherpa is actually Sharwa, meaning people from the east. This is still used for trading. It was used for Tibetans to flee into exile into Nepal over the Nongpala, 19,300-foot pass, and it was closed after a 17-year-old girl was shot by Chinese border guards in the back here as she was 20 minutes from freedom 3 years ago. This is a very big debris-covered glacier, and when I pulled out the photograph and I'd found my place, I just couldn't be sure I was sitting in the right place because this just didn't make sense, that it was now a great big empty lake and a 500-foot deep trench going up 15 miles around the corner. And as this continues, this moraine will fall away, and someday in the not-so-distant future, the Tibetans will no longer be able to trade over that pass into Nepal. The local farmers know their crops and know the weather better than anyone. And these are Tibetan pastoralists. They herd yaks. They grow barley. They irrigate their fields before the monsoon comes. The fields they planted with barley, with water from those glaciers, flows right into their fields. And they were deeply concerned by these photos, and they were often parts of our team. This is the north side of Everest before we leave. We're just always a small, hardy band. We travel very light most of the time. Often we carry all of our own gear with small teams because pack animals can't always go where we need to be. Now we're going to move to Kanchenjunga, the world's third highest mountain in the world, to Jannu. Now we're dealing with the world's... Oh, sorry, I'll go back. That was a little bit fast there. The world's really most renowned landscape photographer, at least in black and white, was Vittorio Sella. 1899, he took this picture as he walked around Kanchenjunga with Douglas Freshfield, and now that glacier is just a trench. As we move further up, just look at his photographs. In terms of black and white, Ansel Adams said of Vittorio Sella, "He is my master." And he took these fantastic pictures. And when we stand there, we see that the glaciers are going very quickly. The scale here is enormous. It's a tremendous loss of volume of glaciers. Look at this shot. This is Kanchenjunga, which has over four summits above 8,000 meters, the world's third highest mountain. On the other side is Sikkim. These are the exact same photographs. There's a glacier here. There's not a glacier here. It's fallen off the picture. It's down here now. And so here's three different sections. These are accumulation zones, so this is what we want to look at, much more than we want to look at terminal moraines, because these tell us the conditions of the glaciers. This is where the two glaciers, the Zemu Glacier and the Kanchenjunga Glacier, melt. And this is one other place that we're going to visit very quickly here. We're going to race off up to the Karakoram, to the base of K2, where the snow and ice that melts from this mountain flows into the Indus River. And as we made our way up to the base of the, to the Tongue, the terminal moraine of the Baltoro Glacier, it's just such a spectacular and beautiful spot, and quite different than the eastern sections of the range, much more much drier, much more savage looking. And actually, we found the glaciers to be in a completely different condition here. They get their snow a different time of year, in the winter, when it can compact and turn into ice, and really keep the glaciers fairly healthy in certain areas. So we need to look at the Himalayas not as just one glacier, and we need to look at it as a 800-mile arc of terrain with microclimates, different weather systems, and there's the terminal moraine of the Baltoro Glacier. This is the water that flows out of it, and this is the, that's a peak I climbed in 1990, so this was my first trip back up here since then. Here's a picture by Vittorio Sella with the Duke of Abruzzi's expedition in 1910. Some of you in the back won't be able to see this. There's 600 of his 1,200 porters camped down here. He was a duke, and he needed his four-post iron bed and a couple of other things along. But this is a big old dirty, you know, rubble-covered glacier, and it's not there anymore. There's a lot of ice left under there. These glaciers are much bigger and much thicker than the glaciers around Everest and Choyoyu and Kanchenjunga. So although these are dramatic pictures, again, three little tents down here, six porters, that gives you some sense of scale. People were telling us over and over again these glaciers are not melting. Prominent scientists said they're not melting. And then I had these pictures, and I called them up, and I said, have you been there? And they said, no. But they had studied them using GIS, geographical information systems, which do not give you a very good idea of vertical melt, just horizontal melt. This is a another one of Vittorio's fantastic photographs. Again, the glaciers, in my opinion, are melting. And so we leave the Karakoram, and just such a spectacular place, and head back to the south side of Everest here before we finish up to a place that means a lot to me and a lot to these guys in the room. And here's our final pictures of what's going on. It's the scale is so enormous that you have to get in close like this and really pay attention and look and hold your eye on something in here and realize some of these pinnacles are 100, 150 feet high, and watch what's happening here on the south side and what's happening to the ice fall and to the place where we used to put base camp when I was first here in 1983. These changes are dramatic. They're accelerating, and they will eventually have very dire consequences for certain populations in India and Pakistan and India and elsewhere. So now let's just talk about something more positive, which is about the Sherpas who make this all possible for me. And there's their, literally some of their brothers there from the village of Changba, Nyima and Mingmar, the Tibetans who made our trip possible, Karsong and Nyima. This was very, very hard work. Their old friend, Changba Tamong from Kumjung. And we have to remember the people like Vittorio Sella, who stood in these places and took these pictures 100, 110 years ago, and Mallory, who took his photo, and Wheeler, who took all the big panoramas, and the first 1921 British Mount Everest reconnaissance expeditions. Those men are like the same heroic figures to me as Hillary and Galen, and it's just great to know that our teams are basically the same. We're out there in the wilderness. We want to come back and bring you important information about a place you may never visit, information that's becoming increasingly vital to an understanding of what's happening to our planet. We love our work. It's hard. It's rewarding. And we can't wait to be headed off again with a team of four or five people with cameras in our packs and pictures to take. Thank you. Here? Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Sit down. Oh, thank you. You're very kind. Thank you. I feel like I just depressed everybody, but it's
yeah,
just,
we were having such a good evening until you came
just,
along. Yeah.
It's actually quite true. The pictures, you know, they speak the truth.
Well, David, first, thanks for bringing the evidence back. We need it. We appreciate it. I have had some questions, and we have about George. We'll keep an eye on this. From George, how long do we have about? About 5-10 minutes. Okay. You know, one of the questions, David, is, and you touched on it at the very beginning, but maybe just paint a little bit of a picture. Maybe we can all surmise this, but As these glaciers melt and as this condition accelerates, what are the consequences that you can sort of enumerate downstream that are likely to hit the Indias, the Pakistans, the countries that depend on this?
Well, that's the big question, and that's what everybody's trying to get their head around and get a pan-Himalayan inventory of the glaciers. How much ice is there? How fast it's melting, and how quickly, or how much is being replenished in the wet seasons. That's the mass balance ratio, they call it. I'm not a scientist, but I've had to learn all these things. A couple of things would be, for a while, there's what I would call an embarrassment of riches. The glaciers are melting, the water's flowing. You go into a village and you talk to them about a future problem, and you're going to need to adapt, and they say, well, what are you talking about, unless you can show them a picture like that. So there will be increased water flow, and sometimes that could be associated if it's associated with warming and wet precipitation, precipitation in the form of water, there'll be flooding. Now, once the glaciers become more devastated or more wasted, as the scientists call it, they will be less able to hold water in any form, either as rain or snow, and store it temporarily and release it over a very long period of time. So you will have, in the warm monsoon season, snow or slush falling that melts quickly and floods downstream, causes tremendous erosion, causes turbulence in the rivers, and affects the entire ecosystem of the river. What these rivers do is these glaciers provide sometimes a very small volume of water into a river. But Craig will tell you this, looking up there, sometimes it's those little fresh streams, and those are the key components, the beginning of that create the overall health of these vast ecosystems. Gloughs, glacier lake, outbursts, floods. You could come up with a big list of things that sounds like the sky is falling and the world will end, but this is going to happen in slow motion over a very long period of time. One of the most dire consequences will be when the glaciers are not there to hold moisture gathered during the wet season, whatever season that is, there's no water to be released during the dry season. So mid-level farmers who rely on that water will be without water. And then when we look at it from a security point of view, and this is the main focus of India and China right now, you get transnational migration, you get people from densely populated areas moving down to very densely populated areas where they cannot be supported, and then you have conflict, instability, and big problems. Population acceleration, resource scarcity, and water scarcity. It's going to be a big collision point 40 or 50 years from now.
Thank you. Looking at lots of other great questions here. Just to follow up on that, you mentioned Rush, who was coming tonight, by the way. He got, for some reason, just couldn't
or
quite
Glenn
make
Beck
it.
Too.
I think it was that it was being held in San Francisco was a problem for him.
Though. That's right.
There have been recent polls that even show that maybe the belief in global warming is actually moving in the other direction in our country, that we may be beginning to slide back. How do we make sure that the tide is turned so that this question of the impact of the glaciers in the Himalayas and what Jim Balog and others are working on actually starts to register in a way that makes a difference?
Well, that's the big, big, big question. The pundits look at the polls, and we think people have climate change ennui and fatigue. It's not necessarily sure, although don't anyone stand up and shoot me, that an inconvenient truth did the whole cause a great service. It was such a big voice and such a shout about the world as we know it is going to end, and then basically people's lives continued, and so why should they change? So there's been a disconnect between what we've told people will happen and what they're feeling is happening. The other thing is the Great Recession caused people to think about immediate priorities and not long-term perceived threats, which are really hard to get your head around and make sacrifices for. But it's the whole thing has to be reframed. Somehow we have to take it, we have to put it in some language that we're trying to understand that resonates with people and makes them want to make the commitment, because all energy use is driven by consumerism. This is a point I have to make to people. You can shout and throw stones at that coal-fired factory or that oil plant, but no energy company ever wanted to supersize my energy and sent me a pamphlet to use more energy. They only sold me what came through that meter, and they're only giving us what we want. So how you're ever going to get an American or anyone to make a sacrifice in their daily lifestyle for something that's not really affecting them, well, that's the big question. So then you look at the other side, how are governments going to come to terms with this? And COP15 was a magnificent failure. Nothing was accomplished. Nobody wanted to come to the table, especially India and China, and they're not going to come to the table. I was talking about this tonight with a couple of people. And really, I think we're going to have to deal with the fact of who we are. You know, we're going to consume more energy in India and China than people are aware of. There's going to be more carbon in the air than we can possibly imagine. And what we should do is prepare now for the consequences and come at another angle and get a new way to deal with mitigation. But really, if we've heard so much about it in this country, and our energy consumption is climbing. We've gotten 10 people in 10 cities to turn off 10 extra light bulbs is what it amounts to. But we are not changing our habits. And that's the big question. It's when we're going to change our habits by the hundreds of millions and ask less from those power plants. And then they will not produce that energy that they can't sell. Simple as that.
It's a snap. Thank you very much. Maybe time, George, for what? One last question, maybe? There you are. Then that big hook comes, and the hotel closes.
Sorry,
by the
it's
way,
a little depressing, but that's what we sit around and talk about all the time with the brightest people on the subject. It's about who we are as people and the sacrifices we're willing to make. One more?
One more, David. We've got time.
Can I just tell people one thing?
Yeah, sure.
Because after I answer this last question, super coolest, best, most awesome picture and technology I haven't shown you yet. It takes 2 minutes, and I really like it because, well, Tony knows his father was a bit of a gadget mathematician guy, and he would have loved this technology.
Okay, so we'll do one. That's great.
Just one. I just want to show you one picture if you give me 2 minutes.
We got it. So we'll do very good. So we'll do one more question. Yeah. Then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, it won't take very long, I promise.
Yeah. Well, they closed the hotel at 9:30, right?
All right.
I mean, the whole thing shuts down. So we're good to go. One more question. We'll do that. Then I will say a couple of last words to kind of wrap it all up, and we've got it. David, for you then, and we saw you. Well, we see you marching off towards the mountains. What is your what's your next adventure out there? Where are you headed next?
Well, we have to start filling in some gaps because the whatever we want to call them, and they do have sometimes very good information. I don't believe in this whole polarized debate. The doubters, the deniers, the people who have good information that says conflicts with my information that I don't like. They're good at what they do. They took that one hole in the UN report, 11,000 pages. And that mistake, and I know the scientist who quoted that, this Indian scientist, glaciers are going to be gone by 2035. They took that and they just ran with it. And then the hacked email at the East Anglia University, they took tens of thousands of words and parsed them out into a few paragraphs that made the scientists look like they're conspiring to create this idea of climate change. So we have to come back with more and more good information from different regions. Our study is not complete enough yet. I know it's not complete enough yet. We have this big gap from Choyo-U, a 600-mile gap up to K2, and then the biggest subpolar glaciers in the world are in the Tian Shan on the border between Kazakhstan and Xinjiang. And those glaciers are, we know, some of the fastest melting glaciers in the world. And unlike the glaciers in the Himalayas, which once they flow into rivers, there's also a lot of groundwater recharge. These glaciers supply water into the farms in the north of the Tarim Basin. This is a desert. There is no agriculture. There's nothing without the water. So we really need to get all our ducks in a row, present our facts in a very cogent and thoughtful, non-dramatic matter, and proceed that way. So I need scientists on my side. I need to get Zongbu and Kami back out in the field, out of Sonoma, carrying big packs again. Not as heavy as the IMAX camera. Okay, so you want to see something really cool?
So now the great photograph.
All right, this is what's called that I need my glasses. God damn it. Sorry about that. So it's not that picture. No, they're trapped in my jacket. All right. This is called a gigapan, and it's a gigapan because it has a billion pixels. And here's what you can do when you have a billion pixels. All right. So first, you remember seeing this glacier? This is the West Rongbuk Glacier. Really, the picture doesn't look like that. You know, we put it in this cylinder. It really looks like that. All right? So let's go back out. Because imagine sitting behind this is that 1921 image. So that if you're a scientist or a young kid or a student who wants to learn more about glaciers, you not only get to have fun like this, but this is just a simple panorama. Anybody can shoot a panorama like this. All right? That's where Major Wheeler stood in 1921. But only, now we don't have tremendous bandwidth here, but only a billion pixels lets you do this, to really go in and look at the glacier. And so now, you know, I love this because my 15-year-old niece, who's so tired of her uncle talking about glaciers, sat down and played with this for an hour. And I realized this is where our project's going to live. It's going to live on the internet because this is where people get their information. It's not, there's Pumori. It's not on TV. It's on computers. It's on the internet. And this is, there'll be stories behind stories behind stories. Let it build. You can see it, the bar in the left. And then I'll just show you Everest Summit and we'll be done. But we have these from all over the range. And behind each of these sits the match photo. We just have to get our funding in order so that we can build that, so that you'll be able to find a little box here. And when you zoom in on it, you'll be able to click from 1921 to 2007. And whoever goes back here and shoots the same spot in 2030, we'll see what the glacier looks like then. But we might as well go in where some of these Sherpas have been so many times, and just have a look at the summit of Everest. So this is, I think it's pretty damn cool. I just like it. There you go. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. We're all done, right?
We're all done.
I'm done.
Oh, David, that is pretty darn cool. I think Galen Barber would like that quite a bit, huh? Well, I want to thank all of you. First, David, thank you so much for this great talk. We really, really appreciate it. One more time.
And to your pals in Sonoma, I'll see you up in Annandale. We'll take a walk up on the hills. I'll carry the gear. That's okay. And to our wonderful Rowell Award winner for the Art of Adventure, Craig Childs. Craig, thank you so much. Really terrific. Boy, I'd love to go on a hike with you. A little jaunt, maybe. You were on fire tonight. That was really terrific. So as we wrap this up, I just want to say again that the Rowell Award for the Art of Adventure is something that each and every single person in this room and everybody you know can be involved in, and we hope it spreads and grows around the world. And what you can do as we move ahead now towards this next year is the Rowell Legacy Committee and the judging panel and Nature Bridge and so forth. We will be soliciting nominations for our next Rowell Award winner to follow in Craig's footsteps or some other footsteps of his or her own. So if you have great ideas on this, think about it, put it together. You can, as I said earlier in the evening, find out a lot more about the Rowell Award and about Galen and Barbara and their legacy by going to rowellaward.com or certainly going to naturebridge.org, a wonderful organization that we hope all of you get involved in and support, doing extraordinary work to get young people into the environment to learn, to care about this place of ours, and to make a difference. So with that, I think there's supposed to be a gavel, George. I don't have a gavel anymore. This is an old Commonwealth. The Commonwealth Club gavel is gone. It's missing. It's gone missing. But I'll just hit the table. So on behalf of our partner organizations, the Commonwealth Club of California, the Rowell Legacy Committee, and Nature Bridge, thank you all for coming, and we are hereby adjourned.